Well, my sermon today is prompted by an article that occurred in the Review and Herald in December last year. And the title of the article is Adventist Conference Marks Controversial Books Anniversary. And it was given at Andrews University. It says, and it's about the book, it says, Questions on Doctrines. Causes a controversial debate, and then it goes through and discusses this. And this is the article that prompts my sermon today. I'm getting to be an old man, and there's not too many people that have been in the church as long as I have and seen these things. The text that I want to begin with is in Revelation. And you're all very familiar with it. It's Revelation 12, verse 17. And the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. And then I have another text which prompts me to preach what I'm going to preach today. And that's found in Ezekiel, the third chapter. And it says, When I say unto the wicked, Thou shalt surely die, and thou givest him not warning, nor speakest to warn the wicked from his wicked ways, to save his life, the same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at thy hand. And the next verse says, But if you warn him, you've delivered your soul, and you won't be guilty of his blood. And then the next 20th verse says, And again, when the righteous man doth turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die. And then it says you're supposed to warn him. And then it says he shall die in his sins, and his righteousness which he hath done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at thy hand. So when a minister speaks, he's got a grave responsibility, and God's going to hold him accountable for what he says or does not say, or what he warns the people about and does not warn them about. So I may run over time a little bit today, but this article in the Review and Herald of December, let's see, the date here is December 20th, 2007, has prompted me to preach this sermon. Very few people could do or say what I have said today because I lived through it. I'm not quoting somebody else. I'm not depending on somebody else's records or remembrances. I started in the ministry in 1945, and I was an ignorant young theology graduate from Pacific Union College. But you know, something interesting happened. I started out in the Arizona Conference, and I went to a workers' meeting that year, and there was an old man. I don't know how old he was, but he had to be past 80, and he got up, and they tolerated him. And he warned and lamented what had happened in 1888 General Conference. Well, in my ignorance, that didn't mean a word to me, 1888 in the General Conference there. But you know, later on I found out what it was all about. And I want to go over a few things with you, because today I'm going to lament not what just may have happened in the 1888 General Conference, but some other things that have happened. And the reason that I'm going to talk about it is that this article in the Review and the Herald, which came out in December 20th, 2007, is a misleading article. But it goes back 50 years. How many of you were an Adventist 50 years ago? One hand only? Two? I'll tell you, that makes me feel real old, but I guess it's all right. This, what happened 50 years ago was they brought out the book Questions on Doctrines. And they had a meeting back at Andrews University in December in which they had conservatives and liberals and all kinds of people there, and they read papers and discussed these things. And they went into some detail in this article. But before I get into this last part, I want to go through a little bit of church history. Because, you know, if we don't know the history of the past, we can't understand the present. So I'm going to go down through the history of the Adventist Church, and I'm going to present it from exactly the opposite viewpoint from what the brethren presented. I had read church histories, and you know, everything was wonderful and fine, and God's been with us all the way, right? So now I'm going to touch on what actually happened. One of the first things that happened was Dr. Kellogg. Any of you ever heard of him? When I started in the ministry, we had Battle Creek treatment places all over the country. And we as Seventh-day Adventists were famous for healing the sick by hydrotherapy and massage and hot baths and all of this type of thing. And all I had to do when I went to Harvest In Gathering to the business people was say, I'm representing Battle Creek in the hospital there, and they, oh yeah, that's a good work, and so forth. Now, I have a book here. It's an old book. I sometimes wonder how it manages to hang together. But it was printed in 1873. How long ago is that?
3 years.
That's a long time ago. And it was written by M.G. Kellogg, M.D. Now, this is not the Dr. Kellogg that was at the Battle Creek and became famous. This is his brother. And the title of the book is quite interesting. It says, The Hygienic Family Physician, A Complete Guide for the Preservation of Health and the Treatment of the Sick Without Medicine. Interesting. And this was the message that Kellogg had. This is the message that God gave to the Adventist Church through Kellogg, and that was, drugs are dangerous. And if you want to read some of the statements that Ellen G. White made, you get this series of books called Selected Messages. And you'll find them in here. And in this, she condemns drugs. But you know what happened? The pressure is being put on the Adventists to conform. And Ellen G. White wrote and said that we were going to be persecuted and that we would be, our liberties would be restricted. And you know what happened? Instead of running head on into the problem, we joined up. And we joined the AMA, and now we, I read on in this book when I spoke months back at Collegedale in Tennessee, and a doctor came to me afterwards, and he says, don't you talk like that again, or we will take care of you. Because the medical profession that is practiced today, friends, has nothing to do with what Kellogg was advocating and the message that God had given to us, because it was a drugless treatment of the sick. That is the first one, compromise, that came in. Then we had a series of things happen, and these all happened in my lifetime. When I was a young preacher, I wasn't even a young preacher. I was actually only in grade school. I was living at Keene, Texas, and a newspaper reporter came out with her photographer and her crew to the college at Keene, Texas, and she wanted to take pictures, and she was going to write an article about it. And, of course, the brethren were happy to welcome her and so forth, but when the article came out, it condemned us as backward. It condemned us as a heretical sect. They classified us with the Mormons and the several other of the religions that were going, Mary Baker Eddy and her teachings, and they said that we weren't Christians. And this was the standing that we had in the world for a long time. But did any of you ever hear of a fellow called Billy Graham? Anybody here ever hear of him? Well, Billy Graham, you know, he was a Southern Baptist preacher, and he was very narrow-minded. The Baptists were all going to heaven. No Methodists would be there, no Adventists, no Catholics. If you weren't a Baptist, you didn't get into the Baptist heaven. But Billy Graham went to a meeting up in the Scandinavian countries, and it was an ecumenical meeting. And he came back, and he had decided that he was not going to be a Southern Baptist anymore, he was going to be ecumenical. And he became a very popular speaker. And the thing that happened was that he would hold these big meetings, and then he would call for the people to come forward for consecration and maybe confess their sins. And then he had the men go out, and these people would be there, and they would interview each person. And if the person was a Catholic, they sent them to the Catholic priest. If he was a Methodist, they sent him to the Methodist pastor. If he was Pentecostal, they sent him to the Pentecostals. And if they were Seventh-day Adventists, Billy Graham sent him to the Seventh-day Adventists. Now, Billy Graham really didn't have much conviction of anything, did he? Because he didn't care whether you were Catholic or Methodist or Baptist or Greek Orthodox. That's where he got sent. And this was the first time that Adventists were, shall I say, kind of treated a little bit tolerant. It was under Billy Graham. The next thing that happened was a fellow called Demas Zakharin. Anybody here ever heard of Demas Zakharin? Well, my wife has, because I've told her about him. Well, Demas Zakharin was a minister, and he didn't like what he was seeing in the churches. He thought they were kind of dead and spiritless and so forth, and he, I don't know exactly whether he had a vision or not, but he ran into a Baptist preacher and some other ministers that were also concerned about the condition of the church. So he organized an organization known as the Full Gospel Businessmen's Fellowship International. And they invited everybody to come. They sent me letters. I was a young pastor, to come to the meetings. And our men went. And they went to these meetings, and they attended the meetings, and I never went. But a classmate of mine that was pastoring in Spokane, Washington, he went to it, and to the meeting, and I happened to go visit him, and he started telling me about it, and I said, well, how many of the Adventist preachers were there? And he said, well, all of them in that section of Washington were in this meeting. And I said, well, you were there, tell me what went on. Well, he said, My wife and I were sitting in the back, and he said when they got up and started speaking in tongues and kind of rolling in the aisles, he says, we left. But I said, how many of the other pastors left? And he said, no, none of them. They all stayed. Now, what happened to the Adventist church under Demas Zakharin was that they got the Spirit in his meetings, and they got confused. Some of them got very confused. One of our leading evangelists got so confused that he came back and he was preaching such wild stuff and advocating rolling in the aisles and getting the Spirit that they wouldn't let him preach for about a year. And finally they got him straightened out and he became the speaker on one of our radio programs. And from then on, but he was confused after that. And this, it had a tremendous impact on the Adventist church, our ministers going there and getting the Spirit. Then HMS Richards, you've heard of him, was invited to speak in Seattle, Washington. Billy Graham was scheduled to speak there, but something came up, he canceled, and he got HMS Richards to speak in his place. And it was one of these full gospel businessmen's meetings. And if you don't believe me, I have their publication and the pictures of the Adventist preachers that were there. HMS Richards spoke and left. But some of the other ministers that were there stayed. And in this little booklet that I have published by the organization, it says they got the Spirit. They spoke in tongues. And after that, they went around and they started calling Adventist preachers and church members together, some of these men that were there, and they would hold meetings in their homes, get the Spirit, and speak in tongues. And I had phone calls to me, Brother Bauer, you know something about this. Is this good or bad? Should I go or shouldn't I go? And I always said, no, stay away. Well, now we've gotten a little ways down through the history here. Then we had a man, his name was Toby Unruh. And you probably never heard of him, but he was the president of the East Pennsylvania Conference, and on Sunday morning he turned his radio on and he happened to turn to a program that was being put on by a very well-known man. And he didn't like it. And I write down this, here it is, it's right here. Donald Ray Barnhouse. And Barnhouse considered himself the authority on the sects, and he was denouncing Adventists. And it was too much for Elder Unruh, so he called him up and told him he didn't know what he was talking about, that his accusations against us were false. And Barnhouse, being a very bombastic man, said, who are you to tell me what to do? And they talked for a few minutes, and then Elder Unruh sent him Steps to Christ and said, we believe just like you, and we're Christians. The next broadcast, Barnhouse got on the radio, and he said, this pastor called me up, said I didn't know anything about Adventists, and sent me a book called Steps to Christ, and he said, I want to tell you something. If that's the Christ the Adventists worship, it's a false Christ. And he continued to rant and rave about how bad the Adventists were. But there was a man on the West Coast. Barnhouse was living back, I think it was in Pennsylvania. And he was the authority on the cults back there. And then there was a guy, Talbot, that lived in Los Angeles. And he claimed to be the authority on the cults. And they were rivals. And they didn't always agree. And I don't know what went on in Barnhouse's mind, but he didn't like his rival on the West Coast, and he thought, if I could kind of expose him a little bit, then I'd be the big shot. And after his contact with Toby Unruh, he contacted the Adventists, and they began to have some talks. And now, mind you, his idea behind it was to expose his rival on the West Coast. And the talks proceeded. And they talked and they discussed things, and our general conference finally appointed some men officially to talk with Barnhouse and his son-in-law, Martin. And they decided, hey, we're going to show that the fellow on the East Coast doesn't, West Coast doesn't know what he's talking about the Adventists. And they decided that Seventh-day Adventists were no longer a heretical cult, but that we were a genuine Christian church. And they gave us a list of questions to be answered about our beliefs. And our brethren answered the questions. And they had them written up, and Barnhouse and his son-in-law, Martin, incidentally, Martin had a photographic memory, and he said, before I'm going to write this book clearing you folks, I want access to everything in the library at the General Conference. And he read the books, and he sorted some books out. Now he said, look, you're telling me that you believe that and thus and thus and thus, but here are some old Adventist books that don't believe thus and thus and thus and thus. And the brethren of the General Conference took the books, and they built a bonfire out in the backyard behind the General Conference, and they assigned different men to go out there and poke the fire and burn these books, these old Adventist books, up. And I'm trying to think of his name now. But I don't see it here. Anyway, this man was poking the fire and burning the books, and one fell off, and he was bored, so he picked it up and started reading it. He liked it. He stuck it in his pocket and took it home. But they were actually burning these old Adventist books and saying we didn't believe that anymore. And the questions on doctrines came out. And Taylor Bunch was on the book committee at the Review and Herald. And I asked him, I said, tell me about it. And he said, well, the book came out, and the book committee at the Review and Herald looked at the book Questions on Doctrines, the manuscript, and we voted not to print it. We refused to print it because it was a sellout. And now they've made a deal with Barnhouse and Martin. What were they going to do? So they set up a committee. Barnhouse and Martin published their book, The Truth About Seventh-day Adventism. It's all here in the article. But the brethren were having a hard time revising the Adventist version so that it didn't go too far one way, and they had to leave enough of their agreements with Barnhouse and Martin so that they couldn't say, well, it was a betrayal, and it took them about a year to get it all redone so that it wouldn't be such a shock to the Adventists, and Barnhouse and Martin would still maybe kind of go along. Later on, Martin became our worst enemy, and for years he had a radio broadcast denouncing Adventists and their deception. But this is what this whole thing is about, this book, Questions on Doctrines. And I, as a young preacher, I said, I'm going to play it safe. I'm not going to buy the book. I'm not going to read the book. And so I can't say anything about the book. I'm going to play it safe. But when the conference sent me brochures advertising the book, I told the janitor, I said, throw them in the furnace. And I didn't have any of it passed out in my church, but one of my church elders went down to Seattle. I was living at Everett, Washington at the time. And he went to the church And Elder Froom, who was one of the men that dealt with Barnhouse and Martin's son, was pastoring the church, and he was praising the book Questions on Doctrines to the sky, how wonderful it was. And the next prayer meeting, this man got up and he challenged me. He said, "Elder Bauer, what's wrong with you? You aren't promoting that book." "Well, I want to know why." Well, Ellen G. White says, when they catch you unawares like that, get time enough to pray and think. So I said, "Okay, next prayer meeting, I'll tell you about it." So I did. I got up and I took this book, which has the very first statement of our doctrines ever published in 1846. And I read from this statement, and I said, "Now," and I read what was in, I had to go get a Questions on Doctrines, and I read some of the things in Questions on Doctrines. And after I had presented what was in the original statement, which Ellen G. White okays, in the little book I wrote to the little flock, I'll read to you what it says about it. At the bottom of the page here, it says, "I believe the sanctuary to be cleansed at the end of the 2300 days is the New Jerusalem temple of which Christ is the minister. The Lord showed me in vision more than 1 year ago that Brother Crozier had the true light on the cleansing of the sanctuary, etc., and that it was his will that Brother C. should write out the view which he gave us in the Daystar Extra, February 7, 1846. I feel fully authorized by the Lord to recommend that extra to every saint." Okay. You read the article, I'll tell you. These men were brilliant and thorough. I don't think they left out one text on the subject. And the article became unavailable, the first original tract, so they republished it as a continued article. And then the next year it was republished again, and it was printed in this Daystar Extra article, and it's entitled "The Sanctuary" by O.R.L. Crozier. And I'll give you a little bit of background there. O.R.L. Crozier was a school teacher. Any of you ever heard of Hiram Edson? Some of you. One of our pioneers, one of the men who went through the Great Disappointment in 1844. And the day after the disappointment, the Adventists were being ridiculed, made fun of, laughed at. So he was going over to see a friend, and he decided to walk through the fields instead of down the street. And he was really worried about the 1844 message and the sanctuary being cleansed, being the earth, and so forth. And while he was walking across and praying and thinking about it, the Lord impressed him that it was the heavenly sanctuary that was to be cleansed, not the earthly sanctuary in 1844. So he wrote this article. And he makes some statements here. I'm not going to read the whole article. And he says here, "But again, they say that the atonement was made on Calvary, when the Lamb of God expired. So men have taught us, and so the churches in the world believe, but it is none the more true or sacred on that account. if unsupported by divine authority. Perhaps few or none who hold that opinion have ever tested the foundation on which it rests. And then he has numbers here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Number 1 is, if the atonement was made on Calvary, by whom was it made? The making of the atonement is the work of a priest. But who officiated on Calvary? Roman soldiers and wicked Jews? Number 2, the slaying of the victim was not making the atonement. The sinner slew the victim. And then he quotes all the texts, you know. You went up and you confessed your sins out in the courtyard by the altar. And then the priest took the blood into the sanctuary. And then number 3, Christ was the appointed high priest to make the atonement. And he certainly could not have acted in that capacity till after his resurrection. And we have no record of his doing anything on earth after his resurrection which could be called an atonement. Number 4, the atonement was made in the heavenly sanctuary, but Calvary was no such place. You remember the Day of Atonement? The priest went in to the second apartment, and he came out and he confessed all of the sins of the people and put them on the scapegoat, and the scapegoat took them off into the wilderness. And that was the atonement, friends, the final act. The next one, number 5, he could not, according to Hebrews 8, verse 4, make the atonement while on earth. If he were on earth, he should not be a priest. The Levitical was the earthly priesthood. The divine priesthood is heavenly. Number 6, therefore he did not begin the work of making the atonement, whatever the nature of that work may be, till after his ascension, when he, by his own blood, entered into the sanctuary in heaven. Now that's the original statement. Questions on Doctrines contradicts that. Because Barnhouse and Martin told our men, as long as you teach this sanctuary in heaven atonement, you're not Christians. And they wanted to be Christians bad enough that they were willing to change it and say the atonement was made on the cross. If you don't believe me, get the book Questions on Doctrines and read it. They just republished it in a new deluxe version. It's in the Book and Bible House. You can get one. You don't have to try and get one of the old originals. It's exactly the same wording. And they, under pressure from Barnhouse and Martin, they changed the atonement and the teaching of the atonement in the Adventist Church. And then they said, well, we got a little problem, so we've got to, what's Christ doing in the heavenly sanctuary? Well, he's not making an atonement. And you can read the book Questions on Doctrines through, no mention of it. Then there were some other things that they decided they needed to change. And they changed them in Questions on Doctrines. let me see here.